Hello, this is Ron Falk for the Department of Medicine at the University of North Carolina. Welcome to the Chair's Corner. Today, we welcome Dr. Peter Noon, who is a professor of medicine in our pulmonary division and is the medical director for the UNC Center for Bronchiectasis Care. This is a brand new center that specifically focuses on the diagnosis and treatment of bronchiectasis and mycobacterial lung infections. And that's what we will be discussing today. Welcome, Dr. Noon.
Thank you very much, Dr. Falk.
So what on earth is this word bronchiectasis? What does it mean?
That's a question I get very often in the clinic, Dr. Falk. It's a disease that is characterized by abnormalities in the airway of patients with chronic lung disease, but classically is associated with a chronic cough, productive of fairly large amounts of sputum, and it's often associated with quality of life issues. The cough interrupts people's ability to go to church, to go to restaurants, be in company, be even on public transport, because it attracts a lot of attention. The sputum production is bothersome, obviously, and then it's often interspersed with periods of stability, punctuated by periods of instability, what we call exacerbations or flare-ups that require treatment.
The word bronchiectasis. Let's talk about that for a minute. So in your lung, you have lots of bronchi. Bronchiectasis. What's the ectasis?
That's a great question because many people confuse it with bronchitis, which is kind of similar but different. Bronchitis is inflammation in the airways, you know, typically associated with viral infections.
So you're saying airways instead of bronchi. Help with that differentiation.
Well, airways are the tissues that get obviously air into our lungs, and then the interchange of blood gases, oxygen, carbon dioxide occurs at the end of the airway. But the airway is an important conducting organ to get the air in and out. So inflammation and problems in the airway obviously can lead to lots of symptoms.
When you take a breath in, the air goes down your trachea. What goes after the trachea?
Larger bronchi, smaller bronchi, airways if you like, and then tiny sort of microscopic airways which lead to the air sacs, also known as alveoli.
So bronchiectasis involves that portion of the airway of any of those bronchi?
Generally not the trachea or the very large airways, but after that, yes, it can involve any portion where there's inflammation and the airway kind of loses its nice tapering quality, which is critical for the normal function of the airway to clear the sort of thing we breathe in and out every day. We're exposed to air, particles, bacteria, dusts, pollens. It's obviously critical that our airways have the ability to clear themselves. And we have a very good automatic mechanism for clearing our airways in the healthy lung. If that gets disrupted in any way, it can lead to abnormalities and disease, and then the airway loses its ability to clean itself. And it gets sort of sludgy, bacteria take hold, and then bronchiectasis may ensue.
So the differentiation of the word bronchitis, inflammation of bronchi, in contrast to bronchiectasis, what's the difference? What is characteristic in the lung if you could zoom in into a bronchus? How would you describe that?
The way I describe it to patients is if you imagine your airways like the branches of a tree, with large branches tapering to smaller branches, tapering to smaller branches, and now envisage that there are knobbles or abnormalities in those branches which leads to pockets, you know, where pus and mucus can build up. If it was a river, there'd be eddies and currents, and sometimes those things enlarge and you get little ponds and pools that become relatively stagnant. Bacteria love that environment, and the airway doesn't clean itself very well in those areas. So you get dilated or enlarged airways in those pockets, which can vary from smaller pockets, smaller airways, to quite large pockets and larger airways, sometimes leading to what we call cavities, very large pockets of pus, mucus, infection.
Right. So those pockets then of infection and the pooling of normal mucus is what then is coughed up and causes the symptoms that you so beautifully described early on. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. The bronchiectasis entity leads to stagnation. And of course, we're all exposed to environmental bacteria, germs. And if those germs take root in the lung, in that environment of stagnation, they can proliferate and cause further damage. So you get into this cycle of damage, inflammation, infection with germs, causing more damage, inflammation, and it goes round and round, and ultimately can damage the lung and the airways quite significantly.
What started it?
Oh, that's an excellent question. If we see small children with these kinds of symptoms, we think genetics. You inherited something from your parents. Cystic fibrosis is a classic kind of disease that we think of in small children or younger adults with this kind of disease. They often have lifelong symptoms since birth. There are other kinds of genetic diseases too that predispose to bronchiectasis. Typically in my bronchiectasis center clinic though, I'll see older people, typically in their 50s, 60s and 70s, who've really had no symptoms for most of their childhood or early adulthood. And then they suddenly develop these symptoms of cough, sputum production, flare-ups requiring antibiotics repeatedly, particularly over winter periods. Actually, often we don't find a cause in those kinds of people. Sometimes they've had a very nasty lung infection that somehow damages their airway and the airway's ability to clean itself. Sometimes they have exposure to very noxious agents, gases, industrial kinds of solvents, that kind of thing. But they form a really fairly small proportion of people. Most often it's what we call idiopathic. We simply don't ever find a cause.
In the naming of your new center, you include mycobacterial lung infections. Does that imply that some of these patients may have tuberculosis or other non-tuberculous causes of bronchiectasis, or are those two entities separable?
Mycobacteria are a family of organisms of which tuberculosis is one member. So there is some overlap and similarity in symptoms and the way patients present, but they're really different bacteria completely in the sense that tuberculosis is very communicable between even healthy humans. Mycobacteria are more environmental organisms that generally aren't that easy to acquire in our lung to cause actual overt infection. So people with chronic lung disease who have injured lungs, particularly those people with bronchiectasis, as I just described it, they're more prone to acquire these organisms, and then those organisms can further add insult to injury, so to speak, and further worsen the bronchiectasis. There are some people who, for reasons that aren't completely clear, can acquire mycobacteria and develop infection even with apparently relatively healthy lungs prior to acquiring the infection. Often their symptoms match that of bronchiectasis patients with cough, maybe weight loss, fevers, night sweats, that kind of thing. And generally a chest x-ray or further fancy kind of CT scanning, etc., will pick up changes consistent with either bronchiectasis and or mycobacteria. Generally, we'll try and gather sputum, collect the mucus that's expectorated from the lung to see what bacteria are there, and we'll particularly look for mycobacteria. The diagnosis is important because the treatment is quite different from mycobacteria versus standard kinds of germs.
How does somebody know that they have bronchiectasis? It's an uncommon presenting diagnosis. They must have been called or diagnosed more than likely with something else, recurrent bronchitis or recurrent pneumonia or some other condition. How does a patient then understand that this really is bronchiectasis and they may really need specialized care?
That's a key question, actually. Many of these patients, because of the vagueness and the chronicity of symptoms, sometimes building up over, you know, years rather than weeks or months, are labeled as having COPD, smokers-related lung disease, even if they have or haven't smoked. They're often mislabeled as having asthma because, of course, they wheeze and cough, much like patients with asthma do. But the key concept is these patients have typically years' worth of symptoms, and they produce typically more sputum or more mucus from their lungs than your average patient with COPD or asthma. So they'll generally bring up a lot of green stuff from their lungs. And if you ask them to describe the volume, they'll tell you it's, you know, maybe a half a cupful per day, sometimes interspersed with blood, which is another key symptom, which typically people with asthma and COPD do not experience.
The diagnostic tests that you may do and kinds of treatments that you may prescribe, give us a glimmer of what kinds of things you do in your center.
Well, you know, we do quite old-fashioned things, which I teach my medical students. A good history is critical. How much do you cough? How much do you cough up in an average day? How long have you been coughing? When did symptoms start? A careful history, in other words. That can often really open the door for the key diagnostic kinds of tests that you might want to do. Physical exam can be relatively non-specific, although there are some things we certainly look for in a physical exam. If I was to pick out one or two tests that are really important for the diagnosis, I would say gather sputum, send it to our laboratory for bacteria, germ growth, various stains and so on, and a CAT scan. The CAT scan really has superseded virtually all other tests that were done prior to this because we have such an exquisitely good picture of the inside of one's lungs, particularly the airways and those pockets that I described earlier.
So when a patient first comes to this bronchiectasis center now at Meadowmont, what kind of questions do they ask you?
You know, many times they'll say, exactly as you've asked me over the last few minutes, what is this strange disease, bronchiectasis? What does it mean for me? Is it going to limit my life? Can you cure it? If not cure, what kinds of treatments can you give me? Is there anything that will improve my quality of life? I would like to be able to sing in the choir. I would like to be able to go on a subway without people saying to me, gee, you need to go and see a doctor, you may have TB. That kind of thing, that really bothers people. Sometimes they've lost weight and they just don't feel very well, which leads to, of course, you know, depression and that kind of thing. So often vague sorts of symptoms really punish these kinds of patients to the point where they are desperate for, if not cure, then at least something that will help them tolerate their life better.
So you've used the word cure twice in the last group of sentences. Can you cure bronchiectasis?
You know, that's one of the things that people ask me too, and for most patients there is no cure. Very rarely we can ask our surgeons to take a look at the situation and they may be able to take out a particularly bad area of bronchiectasis lung. But for the most part, the lungs are affected in a general kind of way and it's not possible to operate. But we certainly have very good management programs to control symptoms, improve quality of life, decrease what we call those exacerbations or flare-ups, which really are the things that destroy people's quality of life. Needing antibiotics several times a year is no picnic. And often people experience side effects from medications and so on. So if we can reduce the number of flare-ups and, more importantly, reduce the number of hospitalizations, because many times these people end up in emergency rooms, they're admitted to hospital, they're patched up, so to speak, for a few days, sent home without really a rigorous future plan of care. So trying to prevent those kinds of things and reduce those occasions when people feel really terrible, that's the key concept.
Are there FDA approved drugs specific for bronchiectasis?
That's one of the things we're really working hard on now. I'll have to say, while bronchiectasis is a disease that has flown under the radar screen for many years, it's sort of come back to the fore, so to speak, and it has garnered the attention of clinicians like myself around the country and around the world to look at this disease that we once thought was cured. You know, after antibiotics were developed in the 1950s, I think people sort of lost interest in many of the chronic infectious lung diseases. But it's back. We know it's out there. We know it's common. Commoner than appreciated. So it's very important that we harness people into centers like the UNC Center, not just here but around the country. We've established a registry. We're trying to capture patients into the registry with their consent. So then we can do good research studies, particularly looking at new medicines to try and combat this disease. And obviously FDA approval is important, because prescribing medicines is one thing, but getting the patient the medicine through the various hurdles of insurance, et cetera, is very important. And FDA approval is one of those things that improves access to good care and good medicines.
You collaborate with the Bronchiectasis and NTM initiative, NTM meaning non-tuberculous mycobacteria. That organization, or that initiative, sponsors wonderful research and a registry for patients with these conditions. Can you tell us a little bit about this initiative and who should join and what sort of studies are coming out from there?
So that's a wonderful national initiative which was started several years ago, mainly by patient advocates who either had loved ones or had the disease themselves, particularly the mycobacterial lung infection spectrum. If we think bronchiectasis is a strangish term, you can imagine your average layperson hearing about mycobacteria, non-tuberculous mycobacteria, MAC, which is a particular germ in that family. They usually know virtually nothing about that disease or those infections. So having access to informative websites, having access to informative patient advocacy groups where they can become informed, they can feel they're not alone, which is very important. People feel quite alone with these kinds of diseases because it's not the sort of thing that their next door neighbor is likely to have. Obviously, that then leads to collaboration with industry, with professionals like myself and colleagues, which is how the registry got started. So we're trying to collect, you know, all the patients around the country that have either the diagnosis of mycobacteria or bronchiectasis. Obviously, that leads to good access to research studies, industry studies. But from the patient perspective, I think the most important thing is being able to feel that they're part of a group where there's activity. There's actually interest from professionals, from societies, leading to good research that will ultimately improve their quality of life and people who follow them with these strange kinds of diseases.
So there's a social support network called Bronch and MTM 360 Social. That's a social network that's really aimed at doing just exactly what you described.
Exactly, yes. The COPD Foundation actually started much of this several years ago, and UNC was a founding member in the registry, which sprang from that, so to speak, and received the early funding for that initiative. The more recent development is the Bronch 360, which is a sort of a blog website where patients can participate, questions and answers, gain resources locally, because not everybody lives in Chapel Hill and has access to a care center, or not everybody lives in Denver, where there's a center much like the one we've just started, and various other cities. So they can see where the resources are locally, or maybe regionally, and liaise with their own local care provider to establish the best practice and best care for those patients.
This new center, the UNC Center for Bronchiectasis Care, is a recent new phenomenon. It's not only comprised of lung doctors, pulmonary doctors. There are a number of other kinds of disciplines that are available for a patient. Could you describe some of those other services that a patient could reasonably expect to have?
One of the reasons, really, that those of us that are at the gestation of this site several months ago decided to proceed with creating the site is that we've been doing this for many years. I started doing this kind of thing as a fellow with Dr. Knowles, who's part of the center. And really, you could argue we've been doing this. Why create a center? Well, visibility, access to care, this kind of thing prompted me to create the center. But also, I thought it would be a good idea to harness the expertise of other people at UNC besides just lung doctors and those of us that have been doing this as our bread and butter for many years. So I've collaborated, and many people who have very, very great expertise at UNC have agreed to help us manage this center. So, for example, ear, nose, and throat doctors have agreed to help us and expedite care as best as possible because many of these patients have sinus disease, nose disease, ear disease. I've enlisted the help of an infectious disease doctor because managing these germs, managing the antibiotics, the complex regime of treatments is not trivial. And many other experts, radiologists, for example. Sometimes we have to really pore over the CAT scan to focus on very specific areas of disease. For example, those that might be amenable to surgery. Access to a really good chest radiologist is so important.
Let me ask you one other question that must bother patients. This is a chronic condition. This is a condition that, as you describe it, is really at times socially debilitating. How do patients cope with this disease? What strategies have you learned from listening to patients?
Well, it depends whether the disease is managed appropriately or not. I'll have to say that there are some patients where if they really don't get a grip on their symptoms, they actually can become housebound. Those of them that are a bit more savvy or on good treatments will often do the best they can to clear their lungs, clear their airways in the morning, do all their, as they call them, treatments, so that they can have a relatively symptom-free day and then refocus on all their treatments again in the evening when they've got home. But I will have to say that many patients do strategize like that and have very complete, fulfilling lives. So I certainly don't want to end on the note of the housebound patient. There are many patients that work, get married, live lives, travel, enjoy vacations. So while there's no cure, appropriately managed, people can have very fulfilled, excellent quality of life.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Dr. Folk.